Well, good morning, Amaga folks. It's Monday morning, about 10 o'clock, October the 3rd. Yesterday, something messed up in our recording of the podcast during the sermon, and our sound guy noticed about halfway through it had somehow shut itself off, and so he turned it back on, but we only captured about the last 20, 25 minutes of the teaching. And so what I'm going to do is, this is going to be a little awkward, so I'm just telling you up front, is I'm going to recreate the first 15 minutes or so, and then at some point we'll cut and it'll go to the live thing. And so it's going to sound a little different. It's going to be a little awkward, but I think the live thing's going to be better. What happened this week, which was unusual for me, is that I ended up manuscripting my talk, and I'll talk about that as soon as I start the manuscript here in just a minute. So I have the pages that we need to get to where we're going. So that's what we're going to do. I'm going to read the text, and then I'll start reading through my manuscript and just do the best I can, and then we'll put it all together. And if you want the manuscript, just let me know. I can give you the manuscript this week, because I actually happen to have one. And occasionally, to make it feel like a Sunday morning, I'll just sip my coffee. All right, so here we go. We're in John chapter 13, and let me so read the text, John 13, verse 1. It was just before the Passover festival. Jesus knew that the hour had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. The evening meal was in progress, and the devil had already prompted Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, and that he had come down from God and was returning to God. So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, "Lord, are you going to wash my feet?" Jesus replied, "You do not realize now what I am doing, but later you will understand." "No," said Peter, "you shall never wash my feet." And Jesus answered, "Unless I wash you, you have no part with me." "Then, Lord," Simon Peter replied, "not just my feet, but my hands and my head as well." Jesus answered, "Those who have had a bath need only to wash their feet. Their whole body is clean. And you are clean, though not every one of you." For he knew who was going to betray him, and that was why he said not everyone was clean. When he had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. "Do you understand what I have done for you?" he asked them. "You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. Very truly I tell you, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed when you do them, or if you, you'll be blessed if you do them." So there in the service, we did our normal customary, you know, people reflecting on the passage and the things that are important to them. And I can't remember all those, and that'd be a little weird here anyway. So let me just start into the manuscript. Sometimes when I'm preparing a passage, it's almost technical. It's working through verses, words, the flow of thought in a passage, and that's the easiest kind of sermon to preach. Those are the ones that are just, they just come, and it's just doing the work and getting it ready. And then there are other times where the text seems to be so intense or so packed with meaning that it's hard to find a good teaching thread. And this passage this week feels a lot like that one. I had last Sunday off, so I've had 2 weeks where this passage has been floating around in my head. And I still this week put off building the slides until yesterday or Saturday because I couldn't find the flow. I just couldn't find, you know, the thread, or I knew things I wanted to say and I couldn't make them all fit. What I actually should say, it's like the passage was so full of important things to say to me that it was really hard to capture what I'm thinking. And so I did something that I haven't done probably in close to 10 years. And actually, I don't think I've ever done it in the history of Imago Dei, except for weddings and funerals. I took the time to write a manuscript. So I have 7 pages of single space. And so on Saturday, I was down in Springfield at the Kiara Center and with our formation community down there. And my good friend, Vicky Brown, and I were having a conversation. I was telling her all this, like, I'm manuscripting my sermon because I can't get it worked out. And she made me feel better because she just said, you know, like, this is one of those passages that it should disturb all of us. It should there's so much meat in it, and it should cause us a lot of self-reflection. So I'm patting myself on the back. I feel a little better now that I that Vicky made me feel better. So over the last couple of weeks, I've pointed out that Jesus's ministry has been moving him away from the crowds and toward his disciples. In the Message version of this passage, which I've been – I know this is like 20 years later, but I have just been recently diving back into the Message. I love it so much. And I'm going to read it at the end of the live sermon. You'll hear me read from the Message again because I just love it. But in the Message, this movement towards the disciples, he calls them his dear companions. And I love that imagery. Like, I think of people along the way in my life who have been like just dear companions. And there's been lots of great people in my life, but there's some people who are that level, dear companions. So here in John 13, we find Jesus surrounded by those closest to him, these dear companions, and at least the 12 disciples are with him in the upper room. And it's likely that probably some others, I think about like Mary and Martha and Lazarus and some of these other characters who are dear companions of Jesus are in this room too. And so John opens up this really intimate, I mean, it really is an intimate scene for Jesus. It's his dearest people. And it gives us this gem, and it says, having loved his dear companions, he continued to love them right up to the end. The word here translated to the end, there's one idea that he literally stuck with them until the point that he was taken from them in the garden, that he was physically present to them. But it also carries the idea of perfection or completion. In other words, Jesus finishes well with his disciples. I think this means two things in the passage. First, that he literally sticks it out with them. That's the most obvious one. But then I think the second one is maybe even more significant. It means that he finished well. He caps off his ministry in a way that fully brings completion to the relationship and equips them for their time away. That he does the work he needs to do in them. That he finishes the relationship that he has with them. It needs to be brought to this level of completion. I want you to think about this for just a minute, and then we'll move on. I want you to think about various relationships in your life. And some relationships just kind of drift away. There's people that we were close to or that we did journey with, and it just kind of, we're not anymore. We're on different pathways. We have different ways of being in the world. We have different circumstances, whatever. There's 1,000 reasons why we drift away. And so we just drift away. But other relationships, especially when somebody's moving away or somebody's moving to a new job and there's just maybe this formal break of that we had this kind of relationship and there's a formal change in it. When those kinds of relationships end, we often we gather. We gather to say goodbye to somebody moving away. I think of a couple of dear friends of ours moved away a couple years ago and there was a party at the Fox Pub and we all just gathered and said our goodbyes and said the things to them that we wanted to say as they were moving away. And so I think that's the idea here, that John is trying to say Jesus did that kind of ending, that the relationship was coming to a close and Jesus was doing and saying the things that he needed to do and say to end well with the disciples. So he begins this passage with love, and love is going to be the link here. But I want to point out, here's the big idea for the message this morning, and I'm going to say this, I think, in the live one when we get there, a whole lot. He says, this love, or he says, I say he says because I'm reading my notes. What I said yesterday is this love isn't sentimentality. It's not just toast and speeches. It's not saying things. It's not having warm fuzzies about somebody. It's not saying I love you. But rather, John wants us to understand the direct link between Jesus finishing well, loving them right up to the end, and his actions. And this is the big theme of was the big theme of yesterday's teaching, that Christian love isn't sentimentality. It isn't just words and warm feelings, but rather this love that Jesus invites us into at the end of the passage. Remember, he says, follow my example. This love that Jesus invites us into is one based on actions. So I want you to pay attention to the flow of thoughts. Verse 2, it says that he loves them to the end. He loves his dear companions right up to the end. And then verse 3 is really interesting, because verse 3, it tells us that Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power and that he had come from God and was returning to God. And I don't know what your theology is about when Jesus became aware. I think there's a popular Christmas song that's played on the Christian radio stations at Christmas, and it kind of depicts Jesus in the manger thinking about the, you know, the structure of the universe. And I personally don't tend to think that way. I think Jesus was a real human baby and didn't have any thoughts. But somewhere along the line became aware of who he was and his mission in the world. And we see hints of it. And we could have a fine, nice little argument about that. John tells us that at least at this point, verse 3, Jesus is fully aware of what's going on in him. Oh, I missed a step. In the middle of that, so he loved him to the very end. And then it says the devil had already prompted Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot, to betray Jesus. And then Jesus knows what's going on. So Jesus is fully aware of himself and his own mission, but he's also aware of Judas and Judas's mission. And so then he gets up at the table. He gets up from the table and begins to wash their feet. So let me say, I want to define this love for just a minute. We use the word love in a lot of different ways, and I know I've said things like this before. I say all the time, especially now, the day after the baseball season where the Cubs won 163 games this year. I love the Cubs. I do. I love the Cubs. And I love good food. I love the opportunity to sit with people and have great food. I love to make good food and share it with friends. I love hanging out with friends. I love playing cards. I love, I love things like that. But the love that John is talking about is the kind of love that goes deep. And saying it that way, I'm not criticizing saying that way, saying that I love the Cubs, that's fine. But I just want us to understand that when we start talking about Christian love and this love that Jesus has for his dear companions, this is love that goes deep, that compels us to sacrifice. This kind of love causes us to change and do hard things. It's the kind of love that Paul talks about when he talks about we will be known by our love. Living with this kind of love, Jesus will demonstrate both in foot washing and eventually in death. Living with this kind of love compels us to not only love the people that are easy, the people we like, the people that affirm us, the people that make us feel good, but even the people that are difficult, those that we perceive as other. This kind of love will call us to change, to become, to change again, and to keep changing and growing. This love, this foot washing love, and then eventually later in the week, this dying love of Jesus is the shape of Christianity. This is what it looks like to be a follower of Jesus. Really, any conversation that we have about following Jesus that doesn't talk about this kind of love and moving deeper into this kind of sacrificing, leaning in, changing myself kind of love isn't Jesus kind of love. This is just a tangent. This is where some of the politics of the day get under my skin. If you're aware, there's an election going on right now. And in the election, there's all kinds of arguments about our country going on. But one of the arguments I'm most interested in is there's an argument about what it means to be Christian in the world. And people proclaim all kinds of things about what it means to be Christian that seem to have nothing to do with this kind of love, as far as I can tell. Our politicians are willing to vilify the other that Jesus told us to love. They're willing to talk about how, like, there's a big discussion about how do we keep people out. People speaking glibly of we should bomb villages and bomb this and bomb that or steal others' resources in the name of good geopolitics, and then ask us to bless it as Christian under the banner of Christian America, in quotes. But hear me on this. I'm not trying to be all political. I just am trying to say as a pastor, the shape and the defining character of Christianity is not strength or power or wealth or even rights. This is the shape of Christianity. Jesus getting up from the table, taking off his outer cloak, getting on his knees and cleaning people's dirty feet. It's Jesus offering himself as a victim of the violent regime. And I said yesterday, if you want to find Jesus, then we find Jesus as the victim and the servant. He sighed. That's where Jesus lives, is among those who serve and those who are the victims. I love, by the way, Jesus' motivation then in this passage. Verse 4 starts with the word so. So he knows who Judas is and what Judas is about to do. He knows his mission. And then verse 4, so he gets up. I think Jesus's motivation right in the very moment, what gets Jesus out of his seat, is that Judas is present. And according to the way John says it, Jesus is motivated to demonstrate this love while Judas is still present. And that absolutely blows me away. I mean, I could have probably done a whole sermon right there. I mean, when I sense somebody doesn't like me, and when I feel somebody is displeased or annoyed or just kind of had it with me, and I know I'm a feeler and some of that is just my own junk, but when I feel like I'm not good with somebody in some way, I just all own my stuff. I retreat, I hide, I run away. I don't like that. It's uncomfortable. And so I get out of there. But Jesus, according to this, Jesus knows what Judas is up to, according to John. And that seems to be at least part of his motivation to wash the disciples' feet, that he'll do it while Judas is still there, that Judas will get to be a part of this, that Jesus will serve even the person who's going to betray him within hours or days, whichever timeline you go on. So let's say a couple of things about this kind of love. I think we're going to say three things, This already happened yesterday. I know I said three things. So three things about this quality of love. This quality of love that Jesus is demonstrating, first of all, requires something of me. When I say I love the Cubs, it requires nothing of me. I mean, okay, it most years it has required of me some level of embarrassment, but it doesn't really cost me anything of note. When I say I love hanging out with friends, playing cards, let's say, it really requires very little of me. But this kind of love Jesus is talking about requires everything of me. The only way I can even begin to talk about this, by the way, is in my own relationships. And so I'm going to talk about Jennifer and I a little bit and being a dad, because that's probably the most intimate, That is the most intimate relationship I have. So being a husband and being a father, the quality of love I have for Jennifer and for the boys is beyond sentiment. I can stand up here and tell you that I love them, and I can tell you all the ways that I can use words. I'm a verbal guy. I can get words to it, and I could have put up pictures of us laughing and having a good time and being a family together, and I could have got all sentimental, and it's been a super melancholy couple days for me, and I probably could have even cried about how what I feel about them. And there's nothing wrong with that kind of sentiment. I feel sentimental about lots of people and lots of things, and it's true. There's a truth to the sentiment, and I'm not putting that down. I'm sure when I look out across the congregation, there's people I feel deeply sentimental about. I really like them. I really love being in their presence. I love conversations with them. But this kind of deeper love that Jesus is talking about is one that asks me to move beyond sentiment and move to sacrifice. Love beyond sentiment is where I choose to do things for Jennifer, my boys, that demonstrate my love. By my actions, I show them that I love them. And this to me is the heart of the passage and what it is to love like Jesus. Jesus literally gets on his knees and scrubs their dirty feet to show his dearest companions, I love you this much. And this is part of why this passage is so challenging to me because I can talk sentimentality all day long. I think all of us can. We can get really sentimental about things, but Jesus is drawing us away from sentimentality to actions. Yesterday in the sermon, right at this point, I made eye contact with Amber Masters, and I was thinking about her class on Love 146 and the issue of child trafficking. And I said in the sermon, it wasn't in my notes, but I just said, like, we don't need more people to feel badly about it. We don't need sentiment. We don't need people to go, oh, that's too bad. I hate that that happens. Let me just go have another party. What we need is people who are willing to sacrifice for the cause, who are willing to say, like, I care about that so much that I'm willing to do something about it. So sentiment is fine at a certain level, but sentiment doesn't change the situation. A relationship doesn't change because you feel sentimental about it. It changes because you lean in. I don't become a better father and a better husband because I feel something about my family. That's fine, but that feeling needs to propel me to a to action. It needs to propel me to leaning into hard times, leaning in to the conversation with them. So Saturday when I was in Springfield with our formation community and I got there early and I was talking to Vicky, I mentioned that up front, and I was giving her a summary because she wasn't going to be at church on Sunday. And sometimes I just need to talk it out. And since and none of those folks got to be at church on Sunday morning, which is part of why I'm doing this like I am doing this for is for you all that were down at the retreat. And she said this, so I'm going to credit this part of the sermon to her, but it really got my wheels turning. And her and I started having a conversation about the difference between pity and compassion. Pity is when somebody feels bad about us. Compassion is when somebody sacrifices and walks with us. The Gospels talk of Jesus as being moved by compassion to action. Compassion is when someone knows about your struggles and they lean in. They bring their gifts, their ability, and themselves to the table with you. This is a powerful insight for me. Like, I've been in the place of pity. We've all been pitied before, right? We've had people who've drawn close because they want to hear our story, and they really do empathize. They really do say, "I'm sorry, that stinks." And that's fine. It's okay to be pitied up to a point. Sometimes that's all we have the capacity to do for somebody is we hear their story and we feel pity for them and we join them in that space, in that moment. But Jesus here is talking about this deeper love with his dearest companions that we can't stop at pity. I can't say to my wife like, "Oh, I'm sorry, that sucks." I have to move towards action. It's in my actions that come alongside of her that demonstrate my love for her, a love that pushes me to lean in, to walk beside her in her distresses or whatever, to sacrifice, to not withhold whatever it is in my power to do. So we're going to do something. Well, we did something in the service where we just we allowed people to give space to share the ways that people have demonstrated love for them. Beyond sentimentality, not something that somebody said, but rather this is what this person did that made me feel loved, that made me know, that helped me know that they love me. Jesus is talking about this deeper love that moves to action, that pushes us to lean in, to walk beside others in distress, to sacrifice, to not withhold whatever it is we have in our power to do. So I want to do something just for fun and maybe a little bit vulnerable, but I hope not. We're going to leave names out of this. I want to just for a minute, all of us, just share a moment in your life where somebody did this. They demonstrated how much they loved us in big ways, small ways. Tell us, like, don't go paragraphs, like a sentence. This is how somebody demonstrated their love for me. Jesus died for you. There you go. I got that one. What else? Yeah. Friends that have cried with you and bought you chocolate malts. I love that because sometimes we think it's grandiose and it's not grandiose. It's even the simple little things that you were known. They know you like chocolate malts. Now we all know this. Yeah. Sometimes when we demonstrate love, it starts a chain reaction, right? It's awesome. I was thinking of my own list about Jennifer and I think I've shared this story before. Jennifer, I'll cry through all these. Jennifer and I were, we'd just gotten married, and we were 3 months into marriage, and we were moving to Denver, Colorado to go to seminary. And we were young, and we were dumb, and didn't really think through the money of moving to Denver or jobs. And this couple that was only a couple years older than us took us to Dairy Queen in Morton one night, and they handed us a really large check. Turns out that check covered our moving expenses because we hadn't thought through that it costs to move, even when you have almost nothing like we had. I have said before, one of the proudest days of my life was my first marathon. And it was just a really big, like, for me personally. Like, I was proud of myself. And I've done other things that I'm proud of in my life, but it was just a personal victory. And at mile 17, I saw some friends that had driven to Champaign. I didn't know they were going to show up standing there cheering for me as I came down the street. My dad, I've built 2 houses, and my dad showed up almost every single day. When I started this last house, he told me, he's like, "I'm 62, I can't help you build your house this time." And then he showed up every day. And I know beyond a shadow of a doubt how much my dad loves me. As I did this list, and there's more,
it dawned on me that this quality of love that Jesus is talking about requires us to learn and to grow. It requires me, if I'm going to be the kind of person that gets on somebody else's list, it requires us to learn and to grow. When I think about Jennifer, the boys, and other people in my life, they all require something different from me. There have been times in my life where I've arrogantly said to Jennifer, I'm going to say that this only happened in the first 5 or 10 years of marriage. I hope it doesn't happen anymore. I said to her at some points in our marriage, like, you should feel loved because I told you I loved you. And while I might have been motivated to show her love in a certain way, I've come to believe in my 20 years of marriage that it's my responsibility, if I'm going to love her well, to demonstrate love to her in the ways that are meaningful to her. The Five Love Languages book rocked my world in year 4 or 5 of marriage. Because I arrogantly assumed that because I felt something about her and because I said things, because I'm very verbal. I don't know if you know this about me. I'm very verbal. because I said some things that was registering for her as love, and she is not verbal at all, and it wasn't even registering to her. And I learned some point along the way that I've got to learn and grow, and I've got to learn to love her in the ways that are meaningful and important to her. And now we have 4 boys, and I'm figuring out like how to love them in the ways that are significant to them and important to them. Over the last couple years, I've started to tell couples in premarital counseling that one of your jobs as a spouse is to become an expert on the person that you are marrying. And it will take a lifetime because we are all so very, very complex. We all like to think we're simple, but I've only met one simple person, me. Like, we all think we're simple because we know ourselves, and to everybody else, we're really complex. I promise you, if I had your spouse sitting here and nobody else, they would say about you, really complex. Sometimes they like this one thing, and sometimes they don't. And sometimes they're in a mood, and sometimes they're not. And sometimes, like, right? So, we're all really complex, and learning to love each other well is a journey of growth. I say to people, like, I was just talking to somebody just in the last week, I think, and I think Jennifer and I both, we're talking about, like, 20 years into marriage, I love her in a very different way than I did 20 years ago. And I'm not perfect at it, and I still screw it up a lot of days. But I'm a lot better than I was 20 years ago. And I hope 20 years from now, I'm going to look back at this period and go, like, I was an idiot then. I've learned more. I've learned better. Almost 2 weeks ago, Brian McLaren's new book, The Great Spiritual Migration, came out. And of course, you know, I think you all know, if you've been around here, he's probably, next to my pastor, probably my spiritual father. And so it got delivered to my Kindle automatically, and I was on vacation, and I read it in like 4 days because I couldn't not read it. And he talks about 3 spiritual migrations he believes we all ought to make. And the first is from a system of beliefs to a way of life. That for many of us, Christianity is a system of beliefs. If I asked you, why are you a Christian, that most of us in our American context would say something like, I'm a Christian because I believe, well, the Apostles' Creed, right? We're going to recite that later this morning. We would say, that's what makes me a Christian. And he says we need to move away from that kind of thinking and move to, I'm a Christian because I live in a certain way. Because I'm actually following Jesus of Nazareth and what he taught. I am a disciple of Jesus. I live in a particular way is what makes me a Christian, not that I believe a particular kind of beliefs. And so in that chapter, he talks about how much of our energy of our church is spent convincing people of beliefs. And we spend very little time talking about the specifics of living. And he proposes an idea that he calls love school. And I love this idea. In fact, I sent an email to Brian Holmes, who's not in here. I sent an email to Brian Holmes like, this is a future Sunday school class, love school, and I loved it. And it's about developing a curriculum or maybe some classes or a course of study where we explore the practicalities of what it means to live well. Here's the thing. I just want to own this. I need this course. We all need this course. I want to be a better lover of my wife, and a better lover of my children, a better lover of my friends, my neighbors, of the other. And I really have little idea of what it is that people say about me when I'm not around, and I think it'd probably be terrifying and depressing. But what I hope and what I'm striving for is that someday when I die, what people will say about me is that he loved well. I hope that if I die before my wife, that she says, in all those years of marriage, he loved me well. I hope that's what friends and neighbors and anybody I come into contact, and I know I'm miles away from that. I'm usually just a selfish jerk. Which brings me back to the passage, and what's hardest for me in the passage about loving well is verse 6. He comes to Simon Peter and says to him, Lord, are you going to wash my feet? One of the commentaries I was reading said we should read this emphatically with the emphasis on the pronouns. Lord, are you going to wash my feet? And Jesus replies, you do not realize now what I'm doing, but later you will understand, which speaks to your point that Jesus is aware that they don't get it and knows that eventually they will. And Peter says, you will never wash my feet. And Jesus replied, unless I wash you, you have no part with me. Which means leads me to this last thing, is that the quality of this love Jesus is talking about requires us to both give it and receive it. That part of this love thing is that it goes both ways. And here's my confession. Here's what my good friend Vicki Brown helped me with yesterday. She helped me to formulate these 5 words. I'm terrible at receiving love. And I said that to her, and she laughed at me and said, you think? She knows me well. I like to be in control. I like to be on my own. I like self-sufficiency. I like to protrude an aura of I don't need anything from anyone else. I'll be fine. I can get through anything if I just put my head down and work hard enough. Let me sneak in a little bit of Enneagram. Like a third of you are in my class, and we're going to talk Enneagram later this morning. And some of you have done this. And if you haven't, just zone out for 30 seconds. We'll be back. I know that some of you by personality type don't really struggle with love. In fact, some of you by personality are irrationally convinced that people love you. But all of us in the heart triad, all of us 2s, 3s, and 4s, and probably the 6s and the 1s, and probably even the 5s, all of us are looking for how to be loved. And are at some level struggling with whether or not everyone really actually loves us. And so we push and we pull and we try to figure out the best ways to receive love. And in fact, in just a little bit, I'm going to be teaching the Enneagram class, and I'll be talking about the 3s, which is my type, which is really vulnerable. And I'm all teary this morning about who knows what. And I came across this week. It says, healthy 3s are continually touched and amazed by the love that others extend to them. And because they are present to their own feelings, they are able to take others' love in. I am miles away from healthy. I don't know how to take others' love in and feel good about myself and present to my own feelings, blah, blah, blah. Rather, I know that when I'm in an increasingly unhealthy state, I can't be present to love because I tell myself I need to work and hustle and achieve to win others' affection. And I'm not the only one in this room that feels like that. I would guess at least half of us struggle at some level with receiving love. That half of us in this room might have responded just like Peter. The thing is Peter gets it. I think more than any of the other disciples, Peter's on to Jesus. Peter's the one who, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Peter's the one at the Transfiguration is like, let's build a booth for all of them. Like, Peter's the one that somehow gets that Jesus is more than just a great rabbi. And I think it's out of that space that Peter says, oh, no, no, no. I'm on to who you are, and this is backwards. This is really, really backwards. Jesus doesn't wash my feet. I worship Jesus. And so, the stupid confession that I have to make sitting here this morning is I don't really know what I'm talking about when I put that slide up about what it means to receive love. I'm trying. I'm working at it. I'm doing the work. The Enneagram's been huge for me, and I'm working hard with my wife, especially on trying to learn to receive love and to be loved. But here's what I know. What Jesus is saying to us at a bigger level is there's reciprocity, this love. We give and we receive. We give and we receive. It's back and forth. Look at verse 12. When they had finished washing their feet, he put on their clothes. He put on his clothes and... Stop. Come out. Can I say one other thing before I go to verse 12? Okay, I have the mic. Did you say no? Wrong. This is just a little short aside. I was talking to this pastor in Chicago this week, and she pastors a church, a collective of churches. And we were talking about one of the dangers of being a leader, of being a pastor, or of being a parent, or of being any kind of leader, is that we set up an artificial position where we give, and then we're not in a position to receive. And some of that's by design, and some of that's good, and some of that's for your benefit. It's not fair to, I think I've said this before, like when you come and meet with Dustin and I, we're supposed to receive, right? Or we're supposed to give to you. We're supposed to be giving to you. That's what we're here for. But somewhere in our spaces, we need to have a space where we give and receive. And what I was talking to this new pastor friend of mine, is she was saying, it's hard for us sometimes to shut off the pastor switch. It's easy for us to keep deflecting and keep making about other people and to keep doing that. And we also do that as parents, and we also do that as supervisors, bosses, that we always feel like we are in the mode where we have to be the authority, we have to be the one to give to others. And we need to find these spaces. I think what Jesus is talking about is part of this fullness of love that he's talking about that's demonstrated, is I demonstrate love by also my ability to receive it and be on the receiving end of somebody else's love. And so this is something to think about, something I'm thinking about. All right, I need to wrap up. We have communion. So look at verse 12. When he had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. Do you understand what I have done for you? You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Like, ding, 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 Peter, you're right on it. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you should also wash one another's feet. Super clear here. I have set you an example, and you should do this. Sorry, it's paraphrasing. No one is greater than their servant or master, and this is what I'm doing. So you know these things. Do them. It's really clear. Some traditions take this and believe that formal foot washing is a thing that we should do. And so, like, especially Eric and I were talking before service, some Mennonites do this. I think it's the Brethren denomination, which is bigger, I think, out east. In the Brethren tradition, once a month, the elders wash the feet of everybody in the church. Don't worry, we're not going to do that this morning. I know. I can see some of you, the wheels are turning like, uh-oh, he's going to ask to wash my feet. No, we're not going to do that. I thought about it. It went through my head. I think it goes beyond a symbolic act. And even in those traditions, they do the symbol, but they also believe that it goes beyond the symbology. That Jesus is inviting us to move beyond sentimentality in our love. It's great to put the word love on the stage. It's great to get a tattoo or put up a painting or some piece of art in your house or sing about love or talk about love or feel mushy, gushy, sentimental feelings about things. To talk about how much we love this person, we love that person and all that. But if we really love, the nature of Christian love, the form of Christianity, is that we demonstrate our love by serving. So here's the invitation this morning. Who do you need to serve? Some of us have gotten into bad places in our marriages, and we've stopped serving our spouse a long time ago. And we need to come back to a place of looking deeply into our partner's eyes and asking, how can I serve you? How do I love you better? Same thing with kids. How do I serve my kids? I know that I demonstrate love to Maddox by playing games with Maddox, right? Yes! What? You like to play games, right? Yeah. So I was gone a week on vacation and came home. You know what I did in the first hour when I was home? I sat down at the table and we played Skip Bow together. And then Jackson came along and beat us both. But I'm learning what it is to love my boys. And that's going to be a hard one because they continue to change and grow and become. And eventually they're going to have spouses and they're going to have their own kids and families. And that's going to be an ongoing project that I'm going to be involved in the rest of my life. Maybe you have a small group or an intimate group of friends. How are you serving them? What about your neighbors? Now, no, I don't want you to go to your neighbors and make broad, like, sentimentality things with your neighbors. It's weird. Don't start proclaiming to all your neighbors, like, I love you so much. That's weird. Weird, weird, weird. But how are you serving your neighbors? In what ways do you demonstrate love without words to your neighbors, to the people in your lives all the time? What about your coworkers? What about the people you run into at the school, you coach with, that you minister to here at church? Some of you this morning demonstrated love by getting up at 6 a.m. this morning and serving the poor. Some of you demonstrate love here by holding babies. Some of you demonstrate love here by giving sacrificially. You choose to give up nights out and vacations so that you can give to the ministry of this church. That's how you demonstrate love. There's lots of ways to demonstrate love here. How are you receiving love? Maybe for some of us this morning is an invitation to start exploring the ways that we receive love, that when people are really trying to love us, that we let them in. One last story, and then I'll be done. I heard a guy say something this week, and I have no confirmation of this, but I want to pass it along anyway because it's great. I was at the Brian McLaren book tour thing Thursday night in Chicago, and there was a Q&R, question and response time, and this guy told a story about a particular denomination, and I'm not going to say the denomination because I haven't confirmed the story, but he said in that particular combination, it used to be a thing that when somebody said, why are you a Christian, There was a particular answer they were trained to give. Now, I think for almost all of us in this room, the way I would answer that is if you said to me, Charlie, why are you a Christian? I would immediately go to a set of beliefs. Well, I'm a Christian because I believe that Jesus is the Son of God, born of the Virgin Mary, suffered under Pontius Pilate, like whatever my thing is. And we in our evangelical tradition then argue about our lists, right? Like it's these things that you have to believe. Nope, it's these things you have to believe. Nope, it's these. But at the end of the day, we all believe that there's a list. That's what we all agree on. And what he said is in this denomination, when they ask the question, are you a Christian? The response you're supposed to give was ask my neighbor. Ask my neighbor if I'm a Christian. Have I demonstrated love to the people around me? Have I loved well? They will know that we are Christians by our love, not our sentiment, not our warm feelings, but about how we demonstrate our love in the same way that Jesus demonstrated his love for us. The way John tells this story is it starts with foot washing at the beginning of the week, and then Jesus even more fully demonstrates his love at the end of the week by dying on the cross. But while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. That he demonstrated his love for us. While we were yet sinners, he died for us. Paul says it this way, let me go over with you again exactly what goes on in the Lord's Supper and why it is so centrally important. I receive my instructions from the Master himself and pass them on to you. The Master Jesus, on the night of his betrayal, took bread. Having given thanks, he broke it and said, this is my body broken for you. Do this to remember me. And after supper, he did the same thing with the cup. This is my cup. This is my blood. This cup is my blood, my new covenant with you. Each time you drink this cup, remember me. What you must solemnly realize that every time you eat this bread and every time you drink this cup, you reenact in your words and actions the death of the Master. You will be drawn back to this meal again and again until the Master returns. You must never let familiarity breed contempt. So the invitation this morning as we move towards the table is to do it in a space of remembering that Jesus washed our feet. Jesus died for us and then said to us, follow my example. And so maybe this morning as you come to the table, maybe there's something. Maybe there's someone, there's somebody, there's some relationship, a marriage, a thing with your kids, or maybe a place that you know that God is asking you to serve in the church or in our community. There's something there. And maybe coming to this table this morning is a space where you honor that. Hey, I recognize that you want me to move beyond my sentimentality in this area and I need to move to action. Let's pray together. Jesus, I'm so convicted by, I'm just a person of words sometimes, and I recognize in myself that I'm just full of sentimentalities, that I say I care about this or care about that or I love this or love that, and then my actions are woefully inadequate. And I'm thankful for the times in my life where people have demonstrated love for me. I'm thankful that while I continue to fumble and struggle, that you died for me and you still love me. And these days I'm getting better at picturing you smiling, walking alongside of me as I fumble in the dark some days. So thank you for your demonstration of love and help us to follow in your example. Help us to love well. I pray that for all of us in this church, that I pray for our church, that what we become known in our community when people think of Imago Dei is not our music or what we teach or all those things, but rather that that's a group of people that loves well. That when people think about me, when they think about my family, they think, those people, they love well. And not so that we get any honor or glory for it, but so that your love for all of humankind is demonstrated through us. In your name I pray. Amen.